Thanks for listening to the Mornings with Carmen LaBurge podcast, made available thanks to support from listeners just like you.
Inspiring you to bring God back into the conversation of the day. This is Mornings with Carmen LaBurge on Faith Radio. If we're gonna fly, we fly like eagles. Arms out wide. If we're gonna fear, we fear no evil. We will rise. By your power, we will go. By your spirit, we are bold. If we're gonna stand, we stand as giants. If we're gonna walk, we walk as lions.
The world changes in a moment. I mean, the world can change in a moment. In fact, that's how the world changes, right? The world changes in a moment. I want you to think about the moment that you heard a particular phrase or set of words, that moment that radically changed your life. Was it the phrase, "I love you"? How did your life change in a moment when you first heard the words, "It is finished," or "I forgive you"? You're pregnant. There's been an accident. You have cancer. You're under arrest. Will you marry me? There's something wrong. Call 911. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. It is finished. The moment that that you hear the words, the world can change in a moment. And the world has never more radically changed than in the moment that Jesus breathed his last. Last night, the mayor of the city of Baltimore delivered his annual State of the City address. It was largely positive, as these events tend to be. There was discussion of the need to clean up the city's harbor. There was a discussion of the need to invest in emergency services and to fight crime. Mayor Brandon Scott said at the conclusion of his speech, "Join me in this fight for the future and the soul of our city. Let us show the world how beautiful Baltimore can be." It was mere hours later that the world changed. 911 dispatchers began receiving multiple calls at approximately 1 a.m. local time in Baltimore. A cargo ship from the Port of Baltimore had struck the Francis Scott Key Bridge, and within seconds, the entire bridge had collapsed into the river. Multiple vehicles fell into the water below. It's cold. The water's murky. Officials are calling it a developing mass casualty event. The Coast Guard is on the scene, as is the Baltimore Fire Department. They are searching for people in the river. There is evidence that there are vehicles submerged. They have pulled two people from the river at this point, one of them seriously injured, the other uninjured. The mayor is calling for prayers, praising emergency efforts. The governor has described has declared a state of emergency. The U.S. Secretary for Transportation is responding with federal resources. The world changed in a moment. That's how the world changes. That's how things change. That's how change happens. What are the words that capture the moment that your world most radically changed? What were those words? Maybe they were words like, "I love you," or "Will you marry me?" or "You're pregnant," "I forgive you." Maybe they are a totally different kind of words. "You're under arrest." "There's a problem. There's something wrong with the baby. I want a divorce." "You have cancer." "There's a lump. There's a tumor." All of those kinds of phrases. What are the words that changed the world in a moment for you? I want to invite you to pray today for the people who were on the bridge and the people who were on the ship. I want you to pray today for the people who are going to have cause today to sink to their knees. They are going to hear a phrase that changes the world, that changes their life in a moment. And let's pray today for one another. For the way the world is going to change in a moment in ways that we cannot anticipate right now. The Supreme Court of the United States is going to hear oral arguments today in a case that could potentially prohibit abortion pills, mifepristone in particular, from being prescribed via telemedicine and sent through the U.S. mail. It is interesting to me how various news outlets are covering this story in anticipation of the oral arguments before the Supreme Court today. Several outlets are talking with providers in states where abortion is on demand throughout terms, like New York is one example here, where there are people mailing these abortion pills to people in states where abortion is banned. And then we have other news outlets that are featuring stories from activists who are smuggling the drugs across state lines, again, into states where abortion is banned. CBS ran content yesterday saying that mifepristone is, quote, safer than carrying a baby to term. I mean, that's just one of those things where you just have to say, what? So it's important to be praying today that the justices of the Supreme Court would have ears that hear and minds that understand and a heart that is turned toward life. Let us never forget that there are two patients involved. Every time there is a pregnancy, there are two patients involved. One who has no voice of their own. And so let us be praying today as the Supreme Court hears this most important case related to life here in the United States of America. Dr. Brett Nix is going to join us next. He's an ER doctor. And I thought it would be really good for him to tell us from his perspective as a doctor what Jesus endured in the flogging and what Jesus endured on the cross. The term excruciating is a term that was made up in order to describe the level of pain that Jesus experienced on the cross. When you describe something as excruciating, you are making reference, whether you know it or not, to the cross. When we describe something as excruciating, we are talking about it being, quote, out of the cross. So we're going to talk about the excruciating experience of Jesus with Dr. Brett Nix. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. What did Jesus suffer? What were his physical injuries? What would have been his experience leading up to and on the cross? We're going to have this conversation with Dr. Brett Nix from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. He is an ER doctor. Brett, welcome back to Mornings with Carmen.
Good morning, Carmen. Thank you. You know, you bring up a great question. As we celebrate this week of Easter, as we go from Palm Sunday into Easter Sunday, many of us take pause on Good Friday, and I don't think that we probably, to the magnitude that we should, understand what the crucifixion was, not just from a biblical perspective, not just from a relational perspective, not just from an eternal perspective, but the sheer pain that was associated with not just physical, but the mental anguish associated with it, you know, the content of sin and those types of things. But if we take a step back and we think about the torture that was inflicted on Jesus, as you mentioned earlier, there was no word that existed prior to that. Historians have looked back and said, as you stated, the term excruciating comes specifically from the term crucifixion or out of the cross in Latin. And when you think about this, you ask your question, so why did it not exist before that? And what is excruciating really, really mean? In the essence of pain, we have to take a step back and say, from a physical perspective, what was this process? And for those who've seen the Mel Gibson movie, The Passion of the Christ, that's probably the closest depiction of what we might visibly be able to see, but certainly not be able to feel. Yes, it's emotional. But if you think about it, even from the start, you have somebody who is being harassed, you know, verbally and otherwise, but then goes on to the flogging. And when you think about that and you look at the imagery, if you've not seen this movie, it is very detailed. It is very graphic. And it is horrific, but this was common. This was commonplace during that Roman period. And when you think about the flogging, it would tear into the skin. I want people to think for a moment, when you cut, you've cut yourself, you've torn yourself, maybe you've been outside and you've used a knife or a chainsaw or something where you've cut yourself significantly. The amount of discomfort, the pain that you have, imagine that coming after you moment after moment after moment, 50 times or more, and not just individual spots, but these are big thing shards of leather that are embedded with pieces of bone and pieces of glass and different types of metals that are there literally to bite into your skin. And as it's pulled back, to go ahead and rip that open. The process with this was not just to the back, but to the front. And it would to expose bone. It would expose blood vessels. And you can even imagine across the front of your body, if it was a deep enough bite, it would actually open up and allow your bowels to be exposed. We call that evisceration. These were things that were not uncommon. This process would be so severe from a blood perspective and from a pain perspective that many never made it to go to the cross. Many would die in the flogging process in and of itself. The very muscles and every aspect of them would be open and exposed. And then, of course, you know, you've got issues. Now, I'm not talking about sanitation. That really didn't exist at that time. But the process then whereby you had to go ahead and carry this tremendous, what we would think of as a railroad timber, across your shoulders and carry this to your spot, as we see dictated and visually present throughout that movie. But you can imagine just the ability to carry that to begin with, the exhaustion of the body. Think about your worst day going to the gym and working out, but doing so after you've been beaten to this degree. And then you want to think about the pain that's associated with it. We watch in horrific detail the hammering of the wrists, not the hands. The hands aren't strong enough to hold someone up, but through the bones of the wrist. And when you watch that, you have to think of it to yourself. There are nerves in that space, and this is driving a large spike right through those nerves. Think about hitting your funny bone, but hitting it and then having somebody literally put a vice grip and pinch down on that constantly, just on one arm into the next arm. And then to do the same across your feet, the extension just to go ahead and put the arms in the crossbar before even raising up many times would dislocate your shoulders by extending you multiple inches in either direction. And then the process by positioning was such that when you are on the cross, the only way you would be able to take a breath is by using your legs to push upward to take a breath. And then you'd have to relax your legs to go ahead and release down. And so most died quickly because of asphyxiation. It's also why in some of the history, if you look at it, many times as soon as someone was up on there, you'd see someone break their legs so they could no longer stand. And so imagine the immense amount of pain, not just from the beating, the immense amount of pain and just sheer anguish related to the event, the pain associated with these nerves that have been impaled and destroyed, and then the inability for you to breathe or even do anything in that process. The term excruciating is probably an understatement.
I just think that there are times we have to take a deep breath and acknowledge that he endured this for us. And so if you're listening right now and you're wondering, why are they talking about what Jesus endured? Because he did it for us. He endured the cross for us. And yes, Jesus saw beyond the cross to the reality of resurrection. Jesus saw the glory of God beyond the cross. And so for the glory set before him, for the redemption that you and I would receive because of his sacrificial death, Jesus endured the cross. So when you are thinking about walking with Jesus this week to the events of that will include his crucifixion, I just want you to be mindful that he endured it for you. We're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Brett Nix in just a moment. We're going to turn to some headlines related to to all kinds of things in the medical world and the scientific community. But let's just linger for a moment at the cross and consider what Jesus physically endured on our behalf. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge, host of Mornings with Carmen. Take a walk with Jesus today. Walk with him from the Last Supper in the upper room where he washed his disciples' feet to the Garden of Gethsemane where he prayed with blood and sweat and tears. Walk with Jesus today as a man bound by Roman soldiers to trials and abuse, and walk with Jesus all the way to the cross. But expect always the unexpected and anticipate miracles, because there's a whole lot more happening than meets the eye when we walk with Jesus. Connecting faith to life, Faith Radio. Continuing our conversation with Dr. Brett Nix from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. He's also an ER physician. All right, we have been hearing in the news, Brett, that there are some possible negative effects of intermittent fasting for some people. You and I have talked about the value of intermittent fasting in the past. So what's up?
It's a great question. You know, we look at this study that just came out, and right now it's only in abstract form, so still waiting on the publication. But basically what they said is, hey, we've been watching 10 to 20,000 people for about 8 years. And those that claim to have intermittent fasting have increased risks of associated death. And the question is, well, what's the story? And we don't know, to be quite honest. We don't know. It's very early in this process. What we do know related to intermittent fasting is that some people do it and they're not healthy. We have people who have eating disorders. We have people that take it to an extreme level, are not hydrating well, and have complexities associated with it. I anticipate if we break this down, we'll end up finding that that is in part the case. At the same point in time, you have people who have underlying medical conditions that require medications that they have to take, certain medications that have to be taken with food. And in that circumstance, if they don't follow the normal guidelines with that, that's going to put them at risk associated with it as well. What we do know physiologically, and much of the studies up to this point, have always pointed more towards the positive aspect of it, which is simply the process of resetting your body, of allowing your body to go to this basal reset where you were able to lower our glycemic index, we're able to bring down the process related to our basal insulin levels. And in navigating that process, restore, if you will, a healthier metabolic process, and also to decrease the total caloric intake in a day when, quite honestly, we on average take in too much. There's always going to be processes when we look at people that are overeating and binge eating, and I suspect we'll probably find that internally, which is I intermittent fast for 16 hours, but then I went out and I had, five meals in a matter of 6 hours. That's probably what we're going to find, is that there's going to be extremes in that circumstance, extremes in that population base, that what they are doing is not healthy. And that's probably the population that we're going to be seeing. So more to come on that. Nothing specific at this point in time other than the usual things. If you go through this process, recognize if your body's not used to fasting, you might feel a little bit lightheaded at times. Make sure you're hydrating. This does not mean avoidance of water and those types of things. Recognize if you have underlying digestive issues or medical issues that require medications, make sure you're taking those things. If you're finding that it's causing issues as far as sleep disturbances or others, not surprising in some individuals, but then again, the question is what's the sleep disturbance? Is it sleep apnea or something different? And the last piece is recognizing you're going to be hungry and you're going to have cravings. That's not surprising during a fast. The question is, when you eat, what are you eating?
We have a listener who's wondering about what they're hearing in relationship to intermittent fasting and cirrhosis. So I don't know. Do you know anything about that?
It's a great question. I don't know a ton about it other than I've seen two different studies that looked at this specifically. And for those that have underlying issues with liver disease, you have a processing issue. And so the challenge with that is sometimes the body builds up toxins. In intermittent fasting process, you are oftentimes going and requiring your liver to transform the storage that you have in the fat in your body. And you have to, the liver has to generate breaking down of that fat into something that your body can use for energy. So if you have underlying liver disease or your liver is not functional, this may not be for you. You may not be able to produce the amount of sugars that your body needs from the fat that you store. And so indeed, that could be the case. Yes.
Interesting. Okay. A genetically engineered pig kidney has been transplanted into a human being. I don't know. Thoughts?
Yeah. This is interesting. So this is something that it's not just grabbing a kidney out of a pig and placing it into an individual. This is taking a pig's kidney and going in, and they have this process. This was up in in Cambridge, and this is up in Cambridge. A company called eGenesis was the one that did this, and this was performed up at the Mass General Brigham Hospital in Boston. They take this pig donor, they genetically edit this process, and it's a known process called a CRISPR process. And what they do is they basically remove, as best we can, harmful pig genes that tend for us, if it was in our body, for us to say, hey, we don't know what this is and we're going to attack it. So it minimizes the immune response. And then they inactivate different types of processes as well as viruses that exist in pigs that we typically don't have that can otherwise infect us. And after they go through this modification process, then it's placed inside the human, still again with the typical medications and things that we have to go ahead and minimize rejection and other issues. But the fact that they were able to take this genetically modified pig heart, or pardon me, pig kidney, and place it inside the human, and so far it's been functional. The question is, you know, what does the downstream effect look like? Whenever we look at genetic modifications of anything, what in time will it do to our normal body, if anything? And so it is interesting, you know, keep in mind, we have so many people that have kidney failure that are on transplant lists, that are on dialysis for the majority of their life. And whether this is a first step towards something that would be very helpful toward those that need it would be fascinating. The question in the background is, okay, we've got this genetically engineered pig kidney through this process that is to allow it to be more compatible with humans. Time will tell what that looks like.
And then I think you alerted me to this link between stress and mortality. I don't think I would be surprised to find a link between stress and mortality for everyone. This one is specifically focused on men.
Yeah, I don't think it's surprising. I think that most of us think to ourselves, the amount of stress we have is directly related to mortality. And that's how most of us would analyze this and saying, goodness gracious, if I have a high level of stress, we know physiologically we're going to get higher levels of cortisol, stress hormones in our body. That's not healthy for us. And of course, over time, if it's persistent, it leads to issues as far as morbidity and mortality. The study actually was asking the question around this, which is, how much effort are you expending to cope with stress? And what they are trying to create a correlation with is simply the amount of effort that you spend to deal with stress is probably a greater influence on its outcome than the stress itself. Meaning, are you one who, when something happens, you perseverate, your coping mechanisms maybe aren't as fluid, and you struggle and you struggle and you struggle with that stressor? Or are you one that has a faith background and you're like, okay, God, I'm lifting this up in prayer and this is yours. I'm not bearing this burden. And so I'm going to go ahead and move forward. Or is your coping mechanism one where you have a conversation, you spend some time in prayer, maybe you exercise, think through this process, and then you move on? What they are simply stating is, we're not sure the mechanism itself is the point that diminishes the impact, but more the duration that you take to try to figure out how to cope with this problem, probably having the greater impact. And if we break this down, it makes sense. The longer that you are dealing with a stressor, the longer those stress hormones are going through your body and having negative effect. If you're able to navigate this with whatever healthy mechanism from coping perspective to let this go, you drop those negative influencing factors in your body and have a better outcome. So time matters.
We've talked on prior occasion about the value of walking and taking some extra steps. So during this Holy Week, I've been encouraging people to literally walk with Jesus back and forth to Bethany. So it was 2 miles each direction. So there you go. That'll be my encouragement during Holy Week, that we would each be, you know, walking with Jesus that loop from Bethany to Jerusalem. So, you know, 4 miles. I thought you'd appreciate
that. Well, I think there's something to be said. 4 miles, 2 miles, whatever those miles are. It's walk with Jesus, and if you have the opportunity, talk with Jesus, right? It's one thing to be in his footsteps. It's another to be in conversation.
I love that. I love that. Thank you so much. Brett, as always, blessed Holy Week.
Thank you. You as well. Have a wonderful Easter, and he is risen.
Amen. Amen. The next time we talk with you, we will say he is risen indeed. Absolutely.
Indeed.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Hey, this is Tuesday of Holy Week, and we are walking with Jesus during these days. So we're going to talk about where Jesus is in the unfolding drama of Holy Week. Yesterday we were with him as he turned over the tables in the temple. We we talked 2 days ago about, you know, Jesus arriving in Jerusalem, and then yesterday walking into the temple courts and and having that exchange with the people who were there. Well, that story continues to unfold. And so on Tuesday, Jesus is in direct verbal confrontation with the religious leadership, particularly the Sanhedrin. And so when, you know, when they take a vote later this week to crucify him, the stage is set on this Tuesday, and some of the things that Jesus says and does in the temple on this Tuesday of Holy Week. And so let's examine that story more directly here in just a moment. We're going to be looking at Matthew chapters 21 and 22 and into chapter 23. We're going to walk with Jesus to the cross. What happened on this Tuesday of Holy Week? That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. All right, you're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We are going to walk with Jesus on this Tuesday of Holy Week. This is a day filled with drama. There is real rising tension with the religious leaders of the day. Monday's arrival in the temple was marked by Jesus's like living parable of cleansing God's house, and then on Tuesday, his time in the city of Jerusalem is marked by very direct verbal confrontation with the religious leadership of the day. And they demanded to know who gave Jesus the right, who gave Jesus the authority to behave as he did in the temple. And so we're going to pick up in Matthew chapter 21 at verse 23. They arrived again. I think I'm going to pick up in verse 27. Let me see. What am I going to do here? I'm going to start in Mark 11. I'm going to do Mark 11, and then we're going to go to Matthew 21. Sorry about that. Let's do it this way. Mark 11, verses 27 to 33. They arrived again in Jerusalem. So again, they have now walked from Bethany, where they spent the night, back to Jerusalem. They arrived again in Jerusalem, and while Jesus was walking in the temple courts, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders, so that's three very diverse groups of Jews, come to him. And they ask, "By what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you authority to do this?" Jesus replied, "Let me ask you a question. Answer me, and then I will tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin? Tell me." Well, they turned to discuss it among themselves, and they said, "Well, okay, if we say from heaven, then he's going to ask, then why didn't you believe him? But if we say of human origin, well, you know, let's face it, we're afraid of the people." Because they, you know, everyone held that John was a prophet. So they decide to confess to Jesus that they don't know. And so Jesus says to them, "Well, then neither will I tell you by what authority I'm doing these things." So their attempt to trap him or to entrap him is answered by Jesus, you know, asking a crafty question that they don't have an answer to. And this confrontation, you know, where they're attempting to put Jesus in his place by forcing him to yield to their authority, that failed. So, you know, what's being exposed here very, very publicly and would have been very humiliating for the Jewish leaders of the day, you know, their attempt to intimidate him by coming to him in numbers. Right? There's three different groups represented when they come to Jesus, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Like, right, they're coming in force. And Jesus doesn't show even the slightest hint of backing down. They try to discredit his ministry. You know, by what authority are you doing this? And obviously, that's not effective. So when you think about the way that Jesus has turned over the tables yesterday, and today, how he turns the tables verbally, you can imagine, it's not hard to imagine, that their anger toward him is growing. And when they demanded that he submit to their authority, he exposed them as having no integrity and no real authority. So there was probably snickering, you know, there was probably some sense that Jesus had put these guys in their place. And that would have sort of contributed to their simmering anger toward him. By Tuesday afternoon, Jesus is going to preach for the very, teach, I think I'm going to use the word teach here, publicly teach in the temple for the very last time. And so he teaches a lot. And so when you think about, well, what were, were some of the last things that Jesus chose to teach when he had the opportunity to freely stand in the temple, you know, these would be important things. So now we'll pick up in the 21st chapter of Matthew. Jesus tells a parable. What do you think? There's a man who had two sons. He went to the first and said, "Son, go and work today in the vineyard." And the son said, "I will not." Later, he changed his mind and he went. The father went to the other son and said the same thing. And he answered, "Yes, sir, I'll go." But then he didn't go. Well, which of the two actually did what the father wanted? And everyone answered, "Well, the first." And Jesus said to them, "Truly, I tell you, the tax collectors and the prostitutes are entering the kingdom of God ahead of you." And when he says "you" there, he is addressing those Pharisees and Sadducees, those scribes, those religious rulers of the day. And again, he's still talking here about John. "John came to you to show you the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. The tax collectors, the prostitutes, they believed. And even after you saw this, you did not repent and believe." And then Jesus tells another parable. We call it the parable of the tenants. Listen to another parable, he says. There was a landowner. He planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it and dug a wine press in it and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. And when the harvest time approached, he sent his servants to the tenants to collect his fruit, right? Because they owe the first fruit to him. But the tenants seized the servants, beat one, killed another, stoned a third. And so he sent other servants to them, more than the first time. The tenants treated them the same way. And last of all, he sent his son. "They'll respect my son," he said. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, "Well, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him. Let us take his inheritance." So they took him, and they threw him out of the vineyard, and they killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what do you think he's going to do to those tenants? "He's going to bring the wretches to a wretched end," they replied. "And he's going to rent the vineyard to other tenants who will give him his share of the crop at the harvest time." And Jesus said to them, "Have you not read the scriptures that the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone? The Lord has done this, and it's marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, I tell you, the kingdom of God is going to be taken away from you. It's going to be given to people who will produce fruit. Anyone who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, and anyone on whom it falls will be crushed." And when the chief priests and the Pharisees heard Jesus' parables, they knew he was talking about them. They looked for a way to arrest him, but they were afraid of the crowd because the people held that he was a prophet. And so Jesus goes on. Again, you can feel the mounting tension, right? You surely by now, you can feel the mounting tension between Jesus and the religious leaders of the day. Jesus tells another parable saying, by the way, we are now in Matthew chapter 22. Jesus spoke to them again in parables saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a king who prepared a wedding banquet for his son. He sent his servants to those who had been invited to the banquet to tell them to come, but they refused to come. So he sent some more servants and said, 'Tell the ones that I've invited that I've prepared my dinner, my oxen, my fattened cattle. They've all been butchered and everything is ready. So come to the wedding banquet.' But they paid no attention and they went off, one to his field, another to his business. The rest seized his servants and mistreated and killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his army and destroyed those murderers and burned their city. And then he said to the servants, 'The wedding banquet is ready, but those I invited, they didn't deserve to come. So go to the street corners and invite to the banquet anyone you find.' So the servants went out to the streets and they gathered all the people they could find, the bad as well as the good. And the wedding hall was filled with guests. The king came in to see the guests and he noticed a man there who was not wearing wedding clothes. And he said, 'How'd you get in here without wedding clothes?' The man was speechless. And the king told the attendants, 'Tie him hand and foot and throw him out into the darkness where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are invited, but few are chosen.'" Now, I got to tell you, when we read that, we think, what is going on here? What kind of parable is this? So, you know, to this point, we have Jesus telling these parables basically about, you know, how the Jews particularly the religious leaders of the day who imagine themselves to be the people who are going to inherit the kingdom of heaven. Jesus saying, look, it's not going to be you. You have not been faithful to the ministry that God has called you to. You haven't been a light to the nations. You've put a heavy burden of laws upon the people. Like you're like whitewashed tombs, right? You know, you clean the outside of the bowl, but on the inside, I mean, I know your hearts. I know what's going on in there. I mean, Jesus, it's really, yeah. But then in the wedding banquet parable, we're also like, okay, well then what is this about the throwing out the guy who got in and wasn't dressed right? So what I'm telling you today is there are parts of these parables that we do not yet fully understand. And I'm going to be the first to admit that. So then Jesus goes on. Well, the Pharisees at this point, they're done. Like they have heard enough. So the Pharisees go out, we're at verse 15, and they lay plans to trap him in his words. They're going to lay a trap for Jesus. So they send one of their disciples in along with the Herodians. And they say, teacher, we know that you are a man of integrity. You teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. That's the way, by the way, if you're wondering, like, how do you butter somebody up before you're going to try to ask them a question to trick them? Yeah, that's how that works. So that's what's happening there. Teacher, we know you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others. You pay no attention to who they are. So tell us then, what is your opinion on this matter? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? So this is another attempt to entrap Jesus here on this Tuesday of Holy Week. How would you answer that question? Is it right or wrong to pay taxes? If you already know how Jesus answers this question, then you don't have to anticipate what's coming next. But maybe you don't know. Maybe you don't know Jesus' answer to this question. But maybe you do know that Jesus sees through the hypocrites who are asking it. So we're going to continue walking with Jesus on this Tuesday of Holy Week, further into this unfolding narrative, this rising tension with the religious leaders of the day. We are in the midst of a conversation where they are trying to entrap him. And so what is before us right now is the question they've asked Jesus. What's your opinion? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
Receive a daily email featuring a scripture graphic. Sign up for the Verse of the Day email at myfaithradio.com.
So we're walking with Jesus on this Tuesday of Holy Week, and we're in the middle of this discourse that he's having with the religious leaders of the day. And so right now, the Pharisees have set a trap for him. They've laid a trap for Jesus, and they've had one of their disciples ask a question of Jesus about the paying of the imperial tax to Caesar. And Jesus, picking up at verse 18 in Matthew 22, Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? All right, show me the coin for paying the tax." And they brought him a denarius, and he asked them, "All right, whose image is on this? Whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. And so Jesus said to them, "So give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, but give to God what is God's." They heard this, they were amazed, and they left him and went away. But let me, this is Carmen now. This is not, you know, this is not reading now, this is reflecting. Whose image is on you? That's the part of this that matters. This is not a question about taxes, which it's a trick. It's intended to be a trick question. So anytime that somebody's like answering the tax question with this biblical passage, you need to stop them and say, do you actually know what that story is about? It's about giving God what is God's. Whose image is on you? You are an image bearer of the living God. Give to God what is God's. Give him yourself. All that you have and all that you are. All that you do. Love the Lord your God in all of these ways, always. All right. Jesus goes on. I'm now at verse 23. There's a lot that happens on the Tuesday of Holy Week, and so I'm trying to cover it all. That same day, the Sadducees, who, let's remember, were sad, you see, because they didn't believe in the resurrection, which is what it says here. So the same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him with a question. Now, again, if they're asking a resurrection question and they don't believe in the resurrection, it's a trick question. So here's the question. Teacher, they say, Moses told us if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up the offspring for him. So now there were seven brothers among us. The first one married and died. And since he had no children, he left the wife to his brother. And the same thing happened to the second and the third brother and right on down the line to the seventh. So finally, the woman died. Now, at the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be of the seven, since all of them were married to her? Now, again, Jesus knows these people don't believe in the resurrection, and yet they're asking a resurrection question. So, right, trick question. Jesus replied, well, you're in error, because you don't even know the scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, which Jesus is affirming there, by the way, affirming that there is a resurrection. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven, which means individuals. About the resurrection of the dead, have you not read, because now Jesus is like, you know, turning the conversation in the direction of what should really be their question, which is a question of resurrection. But about the resurrection of the dead, have you not read that God said to you, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead. He is the God of the living. And when the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. So now, hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. And one of them, an expert in the law, tested Jesus with this question. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment of the law? And Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. This is the first and the greatest commandment, and the second is like it, Jesus added. Love your neighbor as yourself. All of the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. That's a good answer, right? I guess I'm surprised Jesus gave a very straightforward answer when he was asked that question. Well, while the Pharisees were still gathered together, Jesus asked them a question. So he's turning the tables here. What do you think about the Messiah? Whose son is he? The son of David, they replied. And he said, how is it then that David, speaking by the Spirit, calls him Lord? So Jesus is saying David is calling the Messiah Lord. And obviously, anyway, you don't call your son your Lord. So there you go. And then he quotes the scripture here where David says that. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put my enemies under your feet. If then David calls him Lord, how can he be his son? Well, nobody could say a word in reply. And from that day on, no one dared ask him any more questions. Then Jesus said to the crowds, okay, so Jesus is turning toward a different audience here, right? Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you. But do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and they put them on other people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Everything they do is done for people to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplace and to be called rabbi by others. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father, and he is in heaven. Nor are we to be called instructors, for we have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Jesus then goes on to deliver these seven woes to the teachers of the law and the Pharisees. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. He says that seven times. Woe to you, teachers of the law and you hypocrites. Woe to you, blind guides. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. Woe to you, teachers of the law and the Pharisees, you hypocrites. Woe to you, I told you, it goes on and on and on, right? You got to read this today. You snakes, he says, you brood of vipers. How will you escape being condemned to hell? Now, that is very straightforward of Jesus to say to the people who are in a position to condemn him before Pilate. Jesus says, I am sending you prophets and sages and teachers. Some of them will be killed and crucified. Others you're going to flog in your synagogues and you're going to pursue them from town to town. Upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly, I tell you, all of this is going to come upon you, upon this generation. Now, he's referring there to his own crucifixion. And then Jesus says this, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" That is a look back over the shoulder to Palm Sunday, but it's also a look ahead to what is revealed in the book of Revelation. When Jesus left the temple that Tuesday, the chief priests and the scribes sought how to arrest him by stealth. They intended to kill him. They knew they couldn't take his life solely on the strength of the charges that they had to bring against him. Especially if Jesus brought any defense. But he didn't. Instead, he was silent. Jesus is going to offer up his life for a world of blasphemers and traitors and liars. Because this is what Jesus came to do. And so when Jesus left the temple that Tuesday afternoon, he knew. He knew. And if you were with him, if you had been with him, you would have known as well. You would have felt it. The rising tension of this Tuesday is going to result in the Jews coming together and bringing charges against Jesus that will be carried out by the Romans. But at this point on Tuesday, Jesus and his disciples are going to make the 2-mile walk back to Bethany to spend another night in the home of their friends, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. I hope you're walking with Jesus during this Holy Week. You've been listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is Faith Radio. If you're not already walking with us and Jesus during this Holy Week, you can do so at myfaithradio.com. Have a good day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to Mornings with Carmen LaBurge. Podcasts like this are available because of your support. If it's important to you to hear things that encourage your faith, click the link in the show notes to give now. And thanks.